You're listening to the Electronic Media Collective Podcast Network. Yeah, it's a mouthful. For more great shows like the one you're about to enjoy, visit electronicmediacollective.com. And now, our feature presentation.
Welcome to the Middle Age Movie Reviews Podcast. Three guys have been podcasting their entire life and finally decided, well, maybe we should be recording this. And my podcasting partners in crime this evening are...
Maniacal Matt.
Joey.
And here we go again with another motion picture. Joey, would you like to tell the audience what is in the Betamax tonight?
Teaspoon of Evil.
I don't think that's right.
A sprinkle of evil.
Try again.
A splash of evil.
No.
A touch of heroin.
Ew.
Well, that's close enough. It came out in 1958, and it's directed and written by Orson Welles.
All right, gents. When was the first time you seen A Touch of Evil?
The first time I saw this movie was my poor excuse for undergraduate college. It was on VHS in a room full of other people trying to stay awake.
All right. Well, that makes me feel a little better about it because this is the first time, or I should say this, I was touched for the very first time this time for watching Touch of Evil.
That sounded evil.
Is it evil or is it awesome?
Just the Diet Coke of evil, just a touch.
Just a schmither, if you will, please. Mr. Bigglesworth.
One calorie, not that very...
Bring me Mr. Bigglesworth.
That is basically the best thing he ever did was Mr. Bigglesworth.
I'm sorry, Matt, do you want to continue with the podcast, please?
Yes, I too was untouchable of evil, so I had yet to see this movie, Touch of Evil.
So what'd you think of the shoe polish?
I'm like, shoe polish. Oh, yes. Yeah. Yes.
Because Charlton Heston didn't even try to fake an accent. He didn't have an accent when he spoke Spanish in the movie.
Sí, señor. There's no accent, señor. No, none at all. Sí.
Yeah, it's just.
Yes.
Yeah. It was so difficult to watch him as trying to be Hispanic. It was just rough. Especially since you're just waiting for him to be like, get out of my face, you damn dirty apes.
The Uncle Joe Grandy was played by an Eastern European actor, and I think he did a better job. He actually, you know, had a decent accent. You could tell, you know, from all the eye makeup that he wasn't, you know, Latino. But I think he did a good job. He tried to sell it at least.
The makeup did make him look a little more of a Latino than Charlton Heston.
No, he was, I mean, it was real obvious makeup. So I guess he looked like the Liberace of Mexico.
Okay.
But
it was that pencil thin stash.
I was saying his acting was like, he was, whether you believed it or not, like he was making an effort. Whereas Charlton Heston just put on the makeup and had him dye his hair. And he was not even trying to like be Latino. I think he realized it. It was not going to sound very good. And so he's like, well, I'll just talk like myself.
Wait. Whoa. You mean Charlton Heston doesn't talk that way as a true Mexican accent?
You mean this voice is not Mexican accent?
Dude, I don't know what the fuck you just said, but it didn't sound like Charlton Heston.
I think you went back to the Untouchables there, sir. I was a little, you know, a little bit more along those lines.
I would have liked to have seen Sean Connery in this role as Vargas.
Yeah, he probably would have been a better.
It would have been a Spanish peacock origin story.
There you go.
The Highlander.
Senor Vargas. Senor Ramirez.
Yeah. Well, we should probably get into the story synopsis. Matt, you want to tell everybody, you know, instead of them just listen to us talk about this where we're at already.
Right.
Maybe we should like tell them what we're actually talking about.
So I was contemplating about doing this in a Mexican accent.
No.
A Charlton Heston Mexican accent, but yeah.
Which is your normal voice, you mean?
Pretty much, yeah. So, folks, I'm going to do this in my best Charlton Heston Mexican accent. Ready? Mexican narcotics officer Ramon Miguel Mike Vargas has to interrupt his honeymoon on the Mexican-U.S. border when an American building contractor is killed after someone places a bomb in his car. He's killed on the U.S. side of the border, but it's clear that the bomb was planted on the Mexican side. As a result, Vargas delays his return to Mexico City, where he has been mounting a case against the Grande family, a crime and narcotics syndicate. Police Captain Hank Quinlan is in charge of them on the U.S. side, and he soon has a suspect, a Mexican named Manuel Sanchez. Vargas is soon on to Quinlan and his sergeant, Pete Menzies. Sergeant Pete Menzies, when he catches them planting evidence to convict Sanchez. With his new American wife, Susie, safely tucked away in a hotel on the U.S. side of the border, or so he thinks, he starts to review Quinlan's earlier cases. While concentrating on the corrupt policeman, however, the Grandes have their own plan for Vargas, and they start with his wife, Susie.
Dun, dun, dun!
Fun fact, Pancho, the one of the young Hispanic actors, there's a few in this film, they're all the younger characters. His name was actually Val de Vargas. He was a real Vargas.
I did see that. That struck me as funny as well.
Yeah.
I did pick up on that when I was reading who all was in the movie.
What's your name? Oh, you're just like the character. You're hired.
I think we got a name for our main guy. Let's go with that one.
Grease your hair back and put on a black leather jacket.
Can you see that guy? Like every time they're on set, they're like, hey, you know, they start talking like, hey, Vargas. And he's like, oh, me? He's like, no, the character Vargas, not you. Stop answering. Had to be very confusing for him.
That happened. That had to happen.
A positive had to happen.
Hey, you know, since this movie takes place on the Mexican-U.S. border, is it technically considered a foreign film?
I want to say it is, so we can say we've done two now, and I don't have to read subtitles. So, yes, this was a semi-foreign film.
Do they ever say the name of the fucking towns?
They don't.
No, it's a nondescript Mexican-American border town.
So it's California or Texas because of all the oil.
It's Texas. It's Texas for sure.
I got feelings of like early Ciudad Juarez, but like before like a lot of the cocaine and stuff came through.
So this is a prequel to Cartel.
Maybe.
Yeah. They're only dabbling in pot in this one for the most part.
Yeah.
Yeah. We're going to come back to that. Yeah. Marijuana for sure. Definitely was still, what's the word?
The crazy drug all those kids were doing. Yeah, reefer.
Yeah, as I say.
Yeah. But I think before we start talking about that, let's talk about the beginning of the movie. I mean,
yeah. What does Turner Classic Movies go on and on about? The tracking shot at the beginning.
Yeah, I mean, it's fantastic. I mean, it's a solid, I think, 6.5 minutes of a nonstop moving shoot. Where, you know, they must have it all tracked out and everything. But I mean, that's a lot of coordination going on there. It's just beautiful to watch, especially thinking when they shot that and how they did it, you know, at night and everything else. It's an amazing shot. I mean, cinematography is just awesome at the beginning of this film.
I would let that focus puller pull my focus any day.
For sure. I mean, I just sat and thought about how that works because I actually had a conversation with Joey about that because we watched this one together. And I said, you know, is there a guy watching a monitor while they're doing that? And Joe's like, no, not at all. He's like, there's a guy.
Exist.
Yeah, there's a guy that's literally focusing it. You said using measurements, correct, Joe? Isn't that how?
Correct.
So,
there's one guy who could look through, and because of the prism, he can kind of see what the shot's going to be. But that guy isn't on the side of this giant camera. The focus puller is literally marked all of his hits, and they've rehearsed it, and he's going to pull focus based on what they you know, measured out and marked earlier.
And I don't think any time during that you ever see anything really go out of focus. I mean, it's amazingly crisp. It's all the way through that shot. Yeah.
It's a fluid shot, like all the way up to the car explosion.
Which I love. Cause did you notice?
I knew not only did the off camera,
not only did the car explode, but they somehow managed to set an entire water fountain on fire. I don't know how that works, but the water fountain was on fire. I thought that was hilarious.
We had to reverse it. We had to flip it and reverse it and be like, all right, I thought that was like half the car. And he's like, no, it's a fucking water fountain. on fire, and nobody's talking about it.
Yeah. And he's like,
was it an oil fountain? Because that would make sense. Our oil fountain caught fire.
That's how they roll in Texas. We don't mess with water. We just pour oil out of everything. Once a you know, oil rig gets down to the bottom, we just put a fountain on top of it, make it a display.
Maybe, yeah, obviously it was a real common occurrence because none of the fucking characters say anything about it.
Not one person sees anything.
They just walk right by that shit.
And that's where the problem of this film starts for me, is that you go from this beautiful 6.5 minute shoot to a car exploding off camera, which you said was going to happen, Jerry, which is fine because I, back in the day, I'm sure
you couldn't do that in camera and do that whole other shot.
Logistically hard to do. But, and then all of a sudden, 10,000 people are in the shot. They just come out of the woodwork out of nowhere. And it's like you get introduced to all these characters that you kind of get introduced, but not really. And they're just casually talking like, you know, cars blow up, fountains catch on fire every day. It was like the weirdest, calmest reaction I've ever seen. And there's so many people talking about it. You're like, where did all these people come from? And why are they not more freaked out about this? So it was very disjointed for me.
Everybody in town heard it and they all showed up because they were all out that night. And so all these characters are going to be a little bit more important later, and some of them only show up infrequently. Yeah, they're all there all of a sudden. Mm-hmm. So it was kind of convenient. It also gives you maybe intentionally some ideas that maybe one of them was involved with the bombing, but ultimately you find out they weren't. So
right.
It's, yeah, you think that's what the movie's all going to be about. And it's not about the whodunit.
No.
It's about a fat cop.
Yeah, I say it's a noir story about corruption in a small town.
It really became more of who can we prove did it, you know, or who can we say did it, you know? Yeah. But did you find it kind of disjointed, Matt? I mean, how did you feel about that in the beginning?
Well, honestly, I really liked the whole start of it, you know, the whole fluid thing. But then, like, all of a sudden, you see now, from my perspective, it looked like the car just like fell for a split second after it like blew up. So I'm like, did they just like drop the car and then it blew up? It was a little weird. I don't know if maybe they should have had like a multi camera thing, you know, tracking the car as it blew up. But like you said, they couldn't do that. Maybe even for sensor. You know, this the 1950s. I'm sure they probably would have a fit with, you know, the sensor board showing the car blow up.
Yeah. And I mean, the very end of the movie, we see, you know, the black and white, you know, extremely watery blood. But you're right. There's a lot of violence in this, but they probably had to pick and choose what they're going to show. And then I don't think that was a time where you're going to shoot it from three angles and show the car blow up three times.
Right.
But, you know, it so wasn't the 80s.
They're not going to Lloyd Kaufman is what you're saying. They're not just going to, you know, try to keep reusing that over and over.
They're going to reuse the same car again and again.
It's not an Ang Lee, you know, multiple panels showing the car blow up with the Hulk in the background.
Right. Yeah.
Now I would like to see Lloyd Kaufman's Sergeant Kabuki Man NYPD car flip and explosion show up in a black and white version in Touch of Evil. That would have made it better. A Touch of Trauma.
Yeah, that would have been funny.
I would have been a better movie that I might want to watch more than once.
Now, since we're talking about the beginning of the film, did your copy have the whole opening thing about Orson Welles and the letter to the studio about the cut of the film?
Yes, it did, because we were watching the extended version on Turner Classic Movies.
Okay.
And apparently there were some cuts and additional footage that was shot. I think this was the version I saw way back when, because that extended version was originally released in 1998. So he's long dead. They went and got the elements that he did shoot, and they had some notes and they pieced together and said, this is what as close to we think is what he intended, based on his notes. And then his daughter was pissed and they wanted money, blah, 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 blah. And they released the fucking thing anyways. I don't think I've ever seen the quote unquote theatrical cut. And I wonder what that additional footage was. I'm guessing they watered down more of the drug element. I mean, they already watered it down to the point where it's like, you know, they say heroin once. They say mainlining interchangeably with marijuana. So you think, like, do they think they can inject marijuana? But it was originally, they were trying to talk around saying heroin. I think they get to say it one time. And then later they say, oh, it was actually sodium pentothal, truth serum. Like, right. They're going to score that. It's like, we just went down to the local CIA and took some truth serum and we put that into Janet Leigh because we don't want the audience to think she's ruined forever on heroin.
Well, and did you find yourself for a second going, can you mainline marijuana? Like, I don't think that's possible. I should look that up. And
I didn't have to think about that.
Yeah, like, I'm so stupid. What am I? No, you can't mainline marijuana. What the hell's wrong with you?
So. You can vape it. You can bake it. Yeah. They made some kind of like tarry version of this shit that looks like, edibles, I don't want to like say Laffy Taffy. No, it looks like plastic. And it's super concentrated THC and you end up, you know, hallucinating on it. I can't remember what that's called, but you don't inject fucking marijuana.
No, I knew that.
One way you don't take it.
But just for a brief second, I had that moment like, did they have a way of doing that back then? Like,
I don't know why. You can smoke heroin, but you can't inject marijuana.
Well, and it made more sense once they brought up that one heroin comment later on. Like, oh, they meant mainlining the heroin. Okay, you know, but it was, again, the whole script and the way this thing was shot, like, it just becomes very disjointed and hard to follow to some degree because you're just like, this is kind of all over the map. And I don't know if it's because they found the extra shots or they went and shot some more things to try to do this version of it. And in doing so,
trying
to make it better, they made it worse.
The theatrical version had footage that the studio made them go back and shoot.
Okay.
We didn't watch that.
I know watching the movie, I actually watched it in two settings because I got like halfway through the movie. I'm like, I got to turn it off. I'm falling asleep just because of the disjointedness. It was a little hard to follow about midway through the movie. So yeah, I definitely agree that it seemed like it was a little disjointed throughout it. After a while though, it kind of like, as we got towards the end of the film, it became a little more easier to watch.
I think it's because they thinned down the character cast. There was like a lot less people.
There's too much shit going on. It's like, how many old white guys are going to show up in Mexico in this fucking blown up ass car?
Well, and there's not really an explanation of what some of these people do. And like, you see all the people show up out at that one hotel where she's staying, but then they don't do stuff for a long time. Like, what? They're just all hanging out and being kind of weird, you know? It's like, what's the master plan? And it's the same thing with like when he stops in to see, I want to call it the tarot card reading gypsy. She comes out of nowhere and doesn't
another fake Mexican.
Yeah.
There were so many white people in this movie. The Mexicans were white.
right. But
at least three of them.
But
you know, it. Oh, sorry.
No, go ahead, man. Go ahead.
I was gonna say, it definitely felt like. So, like in my notes, I said that like the start of the movie and from the start to about halfway through the movie, it seemed like there were several moving parts. Like everything was all independent to the main plot. Because I mean, you had Vargas's story, you had Quinlan's story, you had his wife's story, and everything was just kind of like all. Just kind of like moving around by itself. Like
did his wife have a story?
Pawns on a chessboard. Well, she had,
I mean, she was a pawn to Grandi.
Yeah.
Which was very clever because they're like, hey, look at the baby. So she smiles. She sees the baby. They take a picture. And then the handsome guy stands behind her. Like they're trying to make her look like a slut.
Right.
Well, and she plays they play her stupid and she lets them continuously do it. Like
I would say,
she seems very intelligent. And she's very aware of who they are and what they're doing, but yet she just keeps letting them do it. Like, oh, let me, like, as soon as they take the picture of me, I'm like, okay, this is wrong. I'm leaving. But she's like, no, let me go into the hotel next. Okay, let me have a conversation with this guy. Oh, but am I free to leave? Like, she just keeps letting them guide her. And
she didn't know she was a prisoner at the hotel till she was a prisoner.
Yeah, well, not when she was a prisoner, but before that, like, she wasn't really a prisoner because he was just talking.
Hanging out in Uncle Joe's place.
Yeah, you know, her and Uncle Joy are just having a little rap session. Or, who, you know, she's like, I know who you are.
and I know you're up to something, but I'm gonna let you keep doing it anyway. You know, it's just, and then she doesn't exactly tell her husband about it. It's like, that'd be the first.
They lied to her. They said, so we have something urgent for your husband.
Well, I know what they did, but why would you go? It's like, okay, let me go with these strange people I've never seen before who are following me through this town. Yeah. Well, that's my point. Like, she doesn't seem stupid, but then she does stupid things. And it's like, it was.
I've never heard of a woman acting like that, Tim. Ever. It's like they don't know how to write female characters.
Well, this is true, I guess, to some degree. But it was just her nonchalantness about it. It was like everybody else in this movie is like, okay, I'll go with you. Okay, there's a car over there on fire. That's interesting. Let's go have a beer over here. You know, it was like a lot of things going on with nobody really paying attention to any of it or caring. It was just
in reality, so a car fucking blew up and she wouldn't have left her husband's side, like, you know,
right?
Beyond not being able to see him.
Right.
Because she's already, you know, startled.
Yeah. Yeah. But everybody there, again, like, oh, this happens every day. Cars blow up all the time.
let's go hang out with strangers.
Yeah.
Who have like a mysterious message for my husband who works in law enforcement in Mexico.
Yeah. So
narcotics.
It just seemed like the story was very poorly written. And I think.
Okay. Let's remember Orson Welles wrote it. Orson Welles played that candy bar eating fat cop very well.
And he keeps saying that he doesn't drink.
Do you think he was really lethargic? Because like he acted like he was drinking before the character was drinking. That guy wrote the movie, Tim.
I understand he wrote the movie, and I think that guy was.
I can't believe he got his clothes on by himself. Like he wrote that script, like he probably dictated it while he was eating candy bars and drinking whiskey.
A chicken bender or something. That guy looked like he was just stuffing the stuff. He was sweating all the time and stuff, and you're talking like this and that. We're going to go get some. Yeah, I'm the cop here. You just know what I want. It's just like, oh my God.
Colonel, this chicken's got. Secret herbs and spices.
Vargas, bring me a candy bar.
Hey, you old gypsy woman, you remember me? We didn't used to have sex in here. You used to feed me chicken until I passed out.
You listen to me, woman. I brought the cane from Citizen Kane to this film, which is going to make it gold. You just do what I want.
That's what that sounds like when I go down on you.
It's just like, wow, this guy's just a big fat pig and you can barely understand him because
I would pay you to leave. Just go.
You have no future here. You leave now. Go buy chicken across the border. Leave me alone.
You reek of the pollo, the chocolate. And the cerveza.
He was a monster looking fellow. I would say he reminded me of like Jabba the Hutt as a detective.
I'd watch that. Detective Jabba. And he's just like, all the other characters, you have to use context clues as to what Jabba's saying, you know, because he's always like, Jabba. And you're like, it was the wife.
And the whole time he's just going to have his partner, Salus Crumb, like, that's all you're going to ever hear that guy say. So
that's Menzies.
Yeah. That's his Menzies.
I thought Menzies would be the protocol droid interpreting for him.
I think that Menzies was kind of, you know, this dopey lackey that they kind of reveal later that like he's had a lifetime. It's like, oh, it's been real easy. Me finding this evidence. I wonder if my boss planted it. he likes to take like, you know, tinkles and sprinkles and little walks, and then he goes, you know what, I'm tired, why don't you go look for it? And then I look for it and I find it, and he says, good job, and then he throws me a fucking treat.
Yeah, let's taste it from me. He's always stealing my candy bars.
why don't you give me the other half of that? I know I gave you a treat, but I'm kind of, you know, my blood sugar's low.
That's why those mounds have two bars in it, one for you, one for me. Give me that bar. I'll eat half of yours.
Remember, Menzies, I took that bullet for you. I got a bullet lodged in my game leg. My game leg, it's just the size of a
tree trunk and it's got a bullet in there. And I'm stuck in all the fucking fat. I did that for you, don't I? I'm going to remind you 7 more times before this night's over that I took a bullet for you, Menzies.
It's still in there because I couldn't find it in all the fat rolls.
That's probably it. Yeah.
Yeah.
You couldn't take it out of my game. Like, by the way, I kept thinking, like, did they say lame? And then they very specifically said game.
Game leg. Is that some old timey shit? A lame or crooked leg was a game leg. I never heard that before.
I've only heard of them referred to as gams. Never. And that's usually when you talk about a women's leg.
It says it's Welsh.
Oh, nice.
Game leg, a lame or crooked leg, a game leg. So that is not made up for Touch of Evil. That's not Orson Welles mispronouncing things or choking on his own neck fat. It's something people used to say.
He spent a few years over in Europe when he was mad at the studios. So, you know, maybe picked up a little bit of the language there, little bit of the sayings. So, okay, Matt, where did you want to go with this?
So, okay, so let's talk, you know, we talked about the evidence that Menzies finds. So is it just me, or does it seem a little convoluted that you'd have someone like use the washroom while they're, you know, investigating the house?
Oh, there's all kinds of ass backwards shit. No, I mean, we can't blame it all on the movie. Maybe everything used to be ass backwards. By the way, police still do ass backwards things sometimes. They're like, you know, I got to take a shit in here. They didn't shoot anybody in the bathroom, did they?
Well, they didn't have the same protocols back then. I don't think they had the Miranda yet. Like, you know, you didn't get Miranda rights back then. None of that stuff was in place. So I think, yeah, it was a lot more casual the way they did things, and you had a lot less rights. Like, basically, it was, well, I mean, what did they do? That guy started protesting, and, well, they pulled out the rubber hose and, like, started beating him, I think, in the other room. So, like, it's like, oh, you want to interfere with the investigation? Here, we'll help you out with that, so you might change your mind. So,
look, you got 2 options. You can confess, and they're going to give you the chair. Or I can beat you to death right now. What's it going to be?
One of those comes with a free meal. So, well, and going to that too, Matt, is simply talk about spoon feeding something like everything is so convoluted in this to me. But then that, you know, Vargas goes to the bathroom and knocks down a very random empty shoebox into the tub. Is like, well, you know, that's going to be important coming down the line.
Exactly. Yeah.
It was like, let us spoon feed this one detail.
On the railing?
Yeah.
Right next to the towels.
Yeah.
Just to let you guys know, I did look it up. The Miranda rights came in 1966.
Yeah, there you go. See, I'm on top of it. I know how that works. That's why there's a lot of police beatings in these old noir movies. They're like, hey, you gonna get a little wise me? I'll show you wise boy. Come over here.
Miranda, we don't have any characters by that name.
I only know about Miranda. You better
put her in the background.
Miranda works down at the docks and she ain't around no more, boy.
So I know it was kind of telegraphed, but I honestly did not think that the guy that Vargas was framing, or not Vargas, Quinlan was framing. I mean, it definitely came off that he didn't, the story made you feel like he didn't do it.
He gave a motive. Like, he was talking really stupid. Like, of course I didn't like, you know, my future father-in-law, and he didn't like me. So he was saying a lot of dumb things, and I think they kind of like wanted to give a little credit to Quinlan that he was a good detective. Mm-hmm. He was just so fat and fucking lazy. He you know, he wasn't going to
do the leg
put
work.
Anything. Yeah, he wasn't going to put. He was going to do in the put in the leg work because he only had one good leg. I'm sure that knee was, you know, bone on bone, and then he also. He wanted a slam dunk. He didn't want to leave anything to chance. He wanted an open and shut case. And he also just happened to have dynamite on his farm. I guess that's the thing.
Apparently.
I kept expecting it to come out later on that it was a Mexican that strangled his wife. And so this is kind of like he's always finding some kind of foreigner or someone to frame in these situations.
I thought they said the guy's name.
Well, I'm saying like at all his cases. Like when
did he say the name of the guy he was pursuing and never caught?
I don't think he did. I think he just talked about that guy killed his wife, strangled her to death, and that was kind of all you hear about it. But I expected that when Vargas went to start looking at his cases, he would be like, you know, look, it seems like every time, you know, he investigates, you know, a Mexican, I'm going to say Mexicans for the most part, because they're right next to the border, they're always guilty and they always get the chair, you know, but that didn't come. So I guess at least he wasn't so lazy that he did that, I guess, to some degree, but I was almost expecting it the whole time.
Yeah. Honestly, you know, he talks towards the end of the movie to Menzies about how, hey, you know, strangling would be the easiest form to kill somebody. And it got me thinking, I'm like, well, did he just like claim that in a roundabout way that maybe he killed his own wife?
I thought that too. Yeah. Yeah.
Cause he doesn't seem like, you know, the type of person, at least in the state that we see him, that someone would want to stay married to. And maybe really the guy he was pursuing was the guy who was just fucking his wife.
Maybe
he didn't kill her. And he, you know, he passed it off to people that, you know, this son of a bitch that, you know, is afraid of me and running from me because I'm trying to kill him. That guy strangled my wife. They never said, did they even say what the fucking motive was?
No, they don't go that deep with it.
No, again, I think he just felt really guilty, and that's when he really started hitting the bottle worse until he switched to candy bars.
I think the only reason they even brought it up is because they had to tie it in later on. You know, I mean, because as soon as you see those gloves come out when he's in that, you know, that little shit can apartment with Uncle Joe there, like, you're like, oh, he's putting the gloves on. He's going to strangle somebody. Somebody's getting the strangle here. And I was surprised he didn't do it with his bare hands. Then he grabs a rope. I'm like, why put on the gloves if you couldn't use a rope? I mean, you know, you're already, right. I mean, I guess so you don't leave fingerprints anywhere, but it was still kind of comical to me, you know, but that was the setup for that the whole time was like, oh, it's the easiest way to strangle. That's what happened to my wife. And so now he uses it as his method of eliminating people that he doesn't like.
I just sent you guys a text. I want you to have a real time reaction to the text I sent you.
Like right now?
Right now.
Okay.
Oh, geez.
Let me open up my phone.
What are you seeing there, guys?
That's just some.
I am seeing a rather poorly done. I'm putting this in the show notes. Yeah, is that
it's a sickle. He killed himself. He didn't want to watch this movie. He's like, that's not worth my death clock. That's it.
It's the bed rail.
Oh yeah, you're right. It is a bed rail. Yeah.
They showed it upside down and did two close-ups very briefly. It's hard to pause. I believe that is the actor. He's got a fake tongue hanging out of his mouth. And I don't know if they drew the eyes on as bulged out or if he's got some kind of apparatus or they painted his eyelids or something, but they're trying to make it look like his eyes are bulged out. And it looks just really, now you got to keep in mind in the movie, you saw that upside down and for like a few frames twice
and in the dark,
but it's really like as laughable as it is, it's also horrific.
It was shocking.
Joe Grandi really, I mean, his character like was definitely like leaning towards, it's like, I feel like I'm in danger, but at the same time he would have fucking bolted.
Yeah.
Because he was, that was poorly written because that guy would have been out the fucking door. I mean, if you would have had someone other than Orson Welles, you know, around, like you could have maybe sold the craftiness and, you know, him being light on his feet and getting in the way or something like that. But instead, like you're with this hulking mass and all you have to do is fucking get the fuck out of there as soon as like you feel like things are going your way.
And I mean, they established that there was a fire escape there. I mean, he could have easily just gone out the fire escape.
Yeah, she does.
But he tries to go out that little like window up top, you know, and it's so funny. You watch that because I'm thinking of that too. I'm like, dude, you got like a walrus chasing you. Unless he like pins you to the ground, you should be able to like get away from this guy. And then they show Orson Welles having like tremendous strength. Like he's picking this guy up. I mean, I've met a lot of fat guys. I've never met a lot of fat, really strong guys, unless they're like one of those weightlifting guys who like, you know, they get all buff and they do their little weightlifting thing and then they kind of let themselves go to pot for a while and then they get ready for the next competition. But mostly fat guys are not that strong, you know, and he's,
they did imply that he can punch people because it sounded like he was beating someone earlier.
Yeah, but he's picking them up. He's picking up another fat man. He's big. Uncle Joey, yeah, he's not tiny either, and he's picking him up like he's like. There's two scenes of that. There's another one where Vargas does that to one of the Mexican hoodlums in the bar. He picks him up. He's carrying him down the bar. I'm like, what is this like? Is this whole Mexican town full of Terminators? What's going on here? Like, I've never been able to pick up another man in my entire life. I could barely pick up my child once he got to a certain age. It was like, you know, so I don't know where this strength's coming from, but it's pretty impressive.
It's super, it's our word strength, super strength.
Yeah. Yeah. It's crazy.
Charlton Heston was the biggest Mexican in history at 6'3". he was also in, pretty good shape most of his life. So yeah, I did buy that Charlton Heston was picking them up. But they never bought that he was from south of the border.
Yeah. So speaking of Charlton Heston, did you guys notice that anytime another character started talking in Spanish? I know they established that, hey, you know, speak English, but it was always Charlton Heston that was like, no, speak English. No, speak English. And I'm like, is he doing that because he didn't want to learn how to speak Spanish? Because I think he only says like two Spanish words in the entire movie.
It was more like two or three sentences, but it was pretty scant.
Yeah.
But yeah, he probably is not multilingual. He probably doesn't know Spanish. So like, look, we're going to keep it, you know, really simple for you. Give you one or two sentences to say. And then most of the time we'll just have you tell the people like, look, you're around all these cops that speak English. You need to speak English. Because most of the time they would speak Spanish to him and he just nodded. It was like, oh, yeah, I see. Oh, yeah, okay. You know, yeah. So yeah. It was more of an acknowledgement.
Pardon me, Captain Quinlan. Pardon me. Let me talk to him for a moment. Donde está la biblioteca? I mean, that's how he delivered the fucking line.
Yeah. Well, but do you expect anything else out of Charlton Heston? That, I mean, that's the way that dude delivers. I mean, he delivers like that Planet of the Apes. He delivers like that in The Last Man on Earth. I mean, that's just how that dude delivers. So,
what's your problem, Quinlan? He was just trying to shop for socks. What's another thing you say in Spanish class?
I don't know. I didn't take Spanish.
Mi lápiz es rojo. My pencil is red.
Oh, where is the bathroom?
Donde está la baña? Labano. Más cerveza, por favor. More beer, please.
Common phrases in high school Spanish.
Yeah, as close as I come to speaking Spanish is trying to sing along with the Desperado soundtrack. So, you nombre, you de grado, but a booster, no mejo, and I'm totally slaughtering that, but you know, it entertains me. So,
I thought you were singing the Salma Hayek parts.
Yes, yeah, so that comes later. Yeah, after I punched myself in the nuts several times.
When Charlton Heston goes all like, you know, ham on the Mexican gang in the bar. Is it just me, or did it seem like that bar kind of fell over pretty darn quick?
I had the same thought. I'm like, this is the cheapest set on the planet.
I mean, yeah.
He just throws his weight around.
He takes the one kid and shoves up against the bar, and the whole bar rocks. I'm like, the bars are pretty heavy.
Yeah. And they're usually loaded down with alcohol, but amazingly, there was nothing underneath that bar. It was like the only balsawood bar in the history of the world. But yeah, they were wrecking that place up pretty good, pretty fast.
So Vargas is like trying to find his wife, going all crazy, beating the crap out of a bunch of people, and then like drives away to try to find his wife. And she's, I mean, I realized there was like crap going on, but you would think that he'd at least be able to hear somebody shouting his name.
Yeah. Yeah, she's very clear. And then when he comes over, everybody gets super loud all of a sudden, and he drives away, and she's back to being able to yell. Like, but the thing that not only struck me about that scene as well, but when he goes around the corner and he goes through the checkpoint, he hits somebody. Literally, you see a guy get mashed by the car and tossed off to the side. I'm like, well, there it is. Vargas the cop just hit a guy, but nobody seems to care about that either. It's just, you know, water under the bridge, I guess. That. Yeah, totally hits a guy. I mean, it's
when?
So he drives through the town and you see her up in the balcony wrapped in the sheet, like screaming his name, and everybody's up there looking at her screaming because, you know, it's like the reenactment of a Mardi Gras or something going on. And so he kind of gets through that crowd, turns the corner and you see him come up to that little booth, which I think is like the customs, you know, border booth back then for that little town.
Yeah.
And as he goes through there, he literally like hits a guy and you kind of see him fly off to the side of that booth a little bit. And
he clipped a guy?
Yeah, he literally clips a guy. I mean, and again, everybody's like, nah, it's okay. It's just Vargas. Yeah, it's just like, okay. It was like, I guess nobody's going to stop this guy at all. It's just let him keep going. It was really weird. It was just one of those weird little things I noticed. And I rewound it and watched again. I'm like, yeah, sure as hell. He hits that guy. So I don't know why it struck me as funny. Haha.
Moments in the movie. Is there anything that kind of like stood out to you guys you liked other than, you know, clipping a guy?
Janet Leigh can't catch a break when it comes to hotel managers.
Let's talk about the night guy.
Oh, gosh.
The night guy was way creepier than Norman Bates.
Oh, he was awesome. Awesome. Miranda, or it was Mirador Motel Night Manager. I think that's what it was. Yeah. Mirador, that's what it was. Yeah.
Owned
that
guy's Uncle Joe. Hence, he knows all the boys. He goes, those are the Grandy boys. It's like, no shit, because Uncle Joe probably has him doing like errands and shit around the cabins. So that should have like set off alarms that like he knew a lot about the Grandies, but he didn't let a lot on. And then he's playing the fucking music. I'll put the music on for you. I'm going to leave for the day, but I'm going to leave this fucking blaring ass music on here because you look like you want to take a nap.
Well, and how about like right after he does that, like he turns on that music and then she looks through the window and he's there staring at her with those weird, crazy, googly eyes of his.
It's enough that she should have demanded her husband come pick her up from the fucking Creepador hotel.
Yeah. Well, what's the next thing she does? You see her with the window still open, laying in bed in that like weird, I don't know what she was wearing. It was like a corsetty nightgowny thing. I don't know what she was wearing, but it's like, that's a weird choice to wear in a
directed by Orson Welles
open window room. So,
yeah, I as naked as the censors will allow us.
Yes, this show doesn't make any sense. You're just gonna have to wear some laundry and get.
Can we show tits yet?
That's where just pull this in.
I'm here to show her my. I showed her my tits, and then she made her show her tits to me, and then I gave her the part. Can I put that in a movie? No.
No, Orson, you cannot. You know, speaking of knockers, so Zsa Zsa Gabor's got a credit in this.
She's in it. I immediately saw her. I go, that's Zsa Zsa Gabor. And like Tim's trying to say it at the same time as me.
Yeah.
I'm like, she gets one scene. I'm like,
you gotta start somewhere.
I think everybody just wanted to be in this movie with Orson Welles. I mean, everybody liked the guy. Charlton Heston insisted that not only act on it, but direct it. I mean, everybody was just locked into wanting to be part of this Jabba the Hutt guy's movie. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like, I'm going to be in this movie. Oh, I want to be in it. You know, it's just like everybody. Yeah. I think, in fact, if I remember right, Janet Leigh, is that how you say your last name?
Lee,
thank
like
you.
Like Jamie Lee.
Oh, yeah. Curtis. Lee, I'm sorry. Yeah, that's right. I forgot. So I guess her manager originally turned the part down for her. And then Orson Welles sent her a letter thanking her for, you know, coming to take the part in the movie. And she brought it to the manager's, her manager, and was like, hey, what's up with this? I want to be in this. It's an Orson Welles film. What the hell's wrong with you? And he's like, oh, the money's not there. And I guess once she signed on, the studio was like, oh, we need to give you some money. So they did pay up, I guess, eventually. But yeah, everybody was just dying to be in this movie with him. So kind of like when we talked about the Hitchcock movies, everybody wanted to be in the Hitchcock movie. So
they were all dying to be in this movie because they were convinced that Orson Welles was fucking dying. He looks terrible in this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. That fat bastard sweated on for another couple decades. Fooled them all.
If he was still around today, they'd say, sir, would you please run for president? You look like you're going to drop at any moment.
Ah, oh, come on. Sure, I just say whatever's on my mind. And
well, where the fuck am I?
I had the feeling that
going to make America beefy again.
I'm going to make America eat again.
I had the feeling that... people were doing it because they're like, oh, hey, Orson Welles is like this acclaimed Academy Award winning director. I'm sure if I'm in this movie, I'm sure to get nominated for an Oscar.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think wasn't this like supposed to be his triumphant comeback to Hollywood to prove that, you know, because like after Citizen Kane, he just kind of kept going down and down and down. And then I think he had a falling out and this was going to be the triumph return. And it just didn't work for him. I mean, it was an epic failure as far as the studio was concerned. Yeah. It didn't get
Touch of Evil was a
later.
Failure.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. It didn't get legs until years later. You can look,
Joey,
you
can do one of your critics.
Yeah. Type it up, Joey. I'm almost positive in that statement. I'm going to stand by my words. It was a, well, it was a failure to the studio.
If you put everything in order of what he's famous for, you got, you know, the radio broadcast of War of the Worlds. Mm-hmm. And then you have Citizen Kane. And then after Citizen Kane, as a layman, a normal person, an average Joe, no pun there for you, Joey. I can't think of anything else after Citizen Kane. It's like all of a sudden after that's it.
Yeah.
And now this is the first time I ever heard of Touch of Evil.
Yeah. I think he went over because he got mad and he started doing foreign films for a while and then came back and he's like, I'm going to prove myself to the studio. And I think he was super difficult to work with anyway. It was like, it's my rear to highway. Now go get me some chicken, you know, but, you know, so yeah, I think he was notoriously difficult. I know I've heard him talk, but it's much funner to do that than it's his real voice. And when he did speak, he actually was pretty dignified sounding.
I mean, he sounded like freaking, he sounded like Pinky or the Brain from Pinky and the Brain.
Yes, yeah, yes.
That's exactly what he sounded like. But I think one of his last roles was in just a voice in Transformers the movie.
Yeah, that I didn't know.
Yes.
Yeah, he's Unicron. Yeah.
Ah, okay.
He doesn't talk a lot.
Probably because he's like, I can't believe this is where my career went.
He's got as many lines of Transformers as Charlton Heston has in Spanish in Touch of Evil.
Yeah.
You Galvatron, go get me some chicken, you fucking robot.
Transform into a bucket of chicken for me, will you?
You're delicious. I'm going to eat this fucking planet.
You know what I like to do sometimes is I wait till the humans get in me and I transform so I could get them nice and tenderized.
I got to transform into an asshole and take your shit now. It got a big room for dinner.
That's Academy Award right there.
But yeah, going back, I guess, way back to the question, it was the night manager that really stood out the best for me during this film. That dude, I don't know, he was creepy as hell. He was just, yeah, all kinds of weird googly-eyed, and I enjoyed his performance greatly. Best part of the film for me, hands down.
Yeah, I'm glad that hotel was out in the middle of nowhere and not near a school.
Yeah.
The guy kind of reminded me a little bit of, like, if you took Jethro Bodine from the Beverly Hillbillies and combine it with the old man from the first Nightmare or the first Friday the 13th.
I was saying that I didn't get to show it to Tim, but I said, oh, this is, you know, what's his name in Friday the 13th? Crazy.
I want to say like Crazy Charlie or Crazy Bob. One second.
Friday the 13th.
Joe's on it.
Yeah. He's on it. Yeah. I actually
Crazy Ralph.
Yeah.
I actually didn't get to finish the movie with him.
I was trying to explain to Tim, I go, oh my God, this guy, you know, grows up, he moves out to New Jersey and becomes Crazy Ralph.
Yes. Yeah.
Cause the hat, he had the hat, he had the mannerisms. I was almost starting to think it was the same fucking actor.
Maybe it's the same, like maybe you're right. Maybe it is the same character. Maybe Friday the 13th is an homage to Touch of Evil.
Did they say the name of his character in Touch of Evil?
Well, it's Dennis Weaver who plays it. He's the night manager. Yeah, Dennis Weaver. So here
I thought it was funny that he'd always complain about the stuff that he wasn't going to do.
He looks actually pretty normal in all the other pictures I've ever seen him in. Oh, it's the guy from McCloud, the old TV series. That's who it is. So
yeah, he can play a weirdo really well. Yeah, he was literally like afraid of Janet Leigh.
Yeah.
He's afraid of everybody.
Yeah.
He's afraid of his own shadow.
Oh my God, you have a vagina. I'm only talking to my mother. Another mother complex, another hotel, another creepy guy. Yeah, she can't win.
Yeah,
for sure.
Another fat fucking bald director.
Well, what stood out for you guys? I mean, what stood out? outside of creepy eyes there, you know?
Honestly, I think the one thing that I liked most about the movie, really stood out to me, is actually just the opening sequence, that whole tracking through the... Oh, wait, no, I want to take that back. The appropriate use of corporate canned rock music in an opening sequence, that's what really stood out to me. As I'm listening to this, I'm like, are they trying to sound like 50s rockabilly?
It could have been just shitty music from the 50s that nobody plays anymore.
Yeah, because I actually think, I mean, when you watch this, the story takes a back seat to the cinematography. I mean, if we're really going to get to nuts and bolts, it's not the story that makes this the movie that it is, like, you know, that puts it in the 1001 movies book for us. It's the cinematography that, to begin with, and the soundtrack second. The movie comes in, you know, the story comes in a third. I mean, honestly.
They actually did real car shots too. Like they did the whole rear projection thing, but then they had a few where it's like, oh, this is, I'm not used to an older movie where it shows them really riding around town in a car, or in this case, Charlton Heston, you know, pulling the wheel all over the damn place. But in fact, you know, he's on a trailer, but he was really going through town. And that was kind of a neat thing to see.
You can always tell when he's not driving because he's doing his best speed racer impersonation there, where he's like back and forth the steering wheel, because that car would just be rocking back and forth completely. So
I like to keep my hands at 10 and 2 and then just go back and forth all over the room.
I have to pretend like I'm driving in an earthquake.
Happy driving.
Yeah. I would say the story actually probably like the fourth thing on the list. Because it was so, like I said, it was so hard to follow there through most of it.
And an interesting choice that they filmed a lot of it in the dark too, like a lot of this was filmed in the dark,
and I think that kind of helped it also helped with the backgrounds and the setting, that being in the dark, it kind of gave more of a I'm gonna say noir-y film or feel to the movie, because it was everything was so dark and
right, well, gritty, which this is that. I mean, they say this is the last great noir movie made, and then that's it. It dies. There's no more after this.
And then came along Who Framed Roger Rabbit, the best noir movie ever from the 1980s.
You are correct, sir.
And they had a villain with bulging eyeballs too.
There you go. Bring it back around.
And a scantily clad woman. So Joey, what about you? What sticks out for you in the film?
Well, other than the disgusting strangulation, I would say what sticks out in the movie for me is the things that don't age well. The Uncle Joe being afraid that his nephews actually smoked marijuana, like it was going to ruin their lives. Not the heroin, the marijuana. The tape recorder that, like, it's got no earpiece and it's like always playing a little bit. So he's under the bridge and it outs him that he's following them around. I mean, I kind of like the fact that, you know, it had a very short distance, but I didn't, you know, the fact that it's always playing the audio, I was like, what? Was that really how it was? Or does he just not know to stick an earpiece in? Did they not have earpieces? There's just a lot of the fact that they have no Miranda rights. There's just a lot of things that don't age well, that take you out of it. And you have to question whether, is this bad storytelling or is this a product of its time?
I like that you brought up the recorder thing too, because it was kind of fascinating to look at that high tech piece of equipment. It's just,
oh yeah, like state of the art back then, I'm sure.
Yeah. It's got that big pull out metal antenna, you know, from all the stuff we remember as kids, like the rabbit ears and the TV and stuff like that. And he amazingly never breaks it. Like, for all the crawling around and stuff that he's doing, he never bends that antenna. I'd have bent that in the first 30 seconds. It just, you know, you're always breaking that thing, and then you're trying to like force it back together and stuff.
I don't think those were battery powered back then, unless he was carrying around a fucking car battery with
him. No, he had a battery, because I mean the bomb in the beginning has batteries. That was the first thing I thought of when I seen that bomb. I'm like, okay, there's your wires, there's your little kitchen egg timer, and it's got like two Rayovac batteries, and I don't know why I think Rayovac, but I just feel like those were the batteries back then. And then you can kind of see some, what I think is sticks of dynamite behind it. So I mean, it did have, you know, batteries back then. And I imagine something like that, it probably had, you remember those great big, I can't even think of what they are. They're giant batteries with the two springs on top of them. You used to buy.
Oh,
them.
Yeah, yeah. Those are the big 12-volt batteries.
Yeah, yeah. Like you buy, put it in like a lantern, and it still only lasts like 20 yes. seconds, and then it'd be dim as hell. But yeah, I feel like that's the battery they probably would have jammed into this thing back then.
Two or three of them. And he was cradling it, and he is a 6'3" fake Mexican.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Who knows?
Crawling around like Spider-Man.
Yeah, Charlton Heston would know if he was holding a gadget that was made up for the movie, but we can't ask him, or if it was that was the tech of the time. I don't know. That it really it kind of stood out. I think his gullible partner Menzies stood out as well. At the end, you know, he has his heroic moment, and to which the retort is, "It's the second bullet I shop for you." And then he spills gravy on, Quinlan, and then Quinlan licks it off his hand and then falls backwards into the river.
Is this somebody going to come and get him? Yeah, eventually. That was another one. They shot him. He falls back. She's like, isn't somebody going to come get him? The guy's like real casual. Like, yeah, eventually we'll fish him out. You know, it's just, yeah, cars blowing up, people falling dead into, you know, the river. No big deal.
ended on two tertiary characters having a conversation, too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Two people that weren't heavily featured in the movie. The one guy who still had some faith in Vargas, and the gypsy storyteller slash seemed like maybe she was a hooker that used to fuck Quinlan, but I'm not sure. She just fed him chicken. We're not sure.
Right. But, right.
We are sure that she is not Latina.
Yeah.
I think the way I'd like to have seen it end is Vargas get in the car with his wife. And he's like, we're going to go now. Mainly because I hit somebody at the border and we got to flee. I think that would have been a great ending.
Quinlan that hit somebody with his car. You said Vargas did it?
No, it was Vargas.
Oh.
Quinlan never got, well, I guess, did he get in the car? I don't know if I ever seen that guy. I guess he was in the car.
Damn, no, Mexicans that just walk right out in front of you.
Yeah, yeah.
You just keep driving and they bounce off like rubber.
And he's like, I've seen YouTube. I know how this works.
They're little. It doesn't hurt them. It's like dropping an ant on the sidewalk. It's fine.
Well, I think I got nothing left in the tank on this one, guys. I've said everything I got to say.
I'm pretty much at the end of my notes. I'm like, I can't think of anything else. I agree with you, Tim, that this is definitely a movie about the cinematography, about the talent of that establishing crane shot and just a lot of the scenes.
Until they're like, we're in a small hotel room and just doing upward angle.
Yeah.
All of us standing on top of each other. And then when you got to make the story elements that Heston doesn't fit in the fucking elevator, or you got the cameraman in the corner with his giant piece of fucking rig. And he's going to, oh, he took this, you went up the stairs fast. And it's like, no, the lift is slow.
Yeah. Was like, that supposed to be some kind of pivotal story moment, or just, I mean, the conversation they wanted in the elevator
on them talking shit about him too. So yeah, they turned a minus into a plus. They're like, well, what if we all cram in the elevator and he takes the stairs and he gets up there first and he hears us talking shit about him. Plus we can't, you know, Gus with the fucking camera, like, you know, we can only fit, you know, a couple of these motherfuckers in here.
That's what I see it going. You got like, you know, Gus with the camera. You know, there's too many people. Like, I gotta have room for the camera. Like, we can't have four people. Like, what are we gonna do with Vargas? It's like,
come on, Gus. I'm gonna slather you in chicken grease and we're gonna squeeze you in there.
Then I can't. Charlton, you're in good shape. Can you go up to staircase and meet them on the flat? He's like, whatever, okay. Don't
break a sweat. My shoe polish is going to come off. Oh, by the way, how did they have him wash his fucking face? Did he just mime washing his face and the makeup didn't come off onto all the towels and shit?
Because there's times when he turns and you can kind of see where the makeup kind of ends towards the back of his neck. And I'm like, oh, look, there's a half white, half Mexican, I guess. So.
Unless they found a desert that was cold, I don't know how the fuck he wasn't sweating it off.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, like I said, the only person I seen sweating in that whole show was Orson Welles, you know.
No, I don't know. I seen, obviously, Uncle Joe.
Yeah, I guess you're right. A little bit. Yeah, I guess I'm just so focused on Orson Welles because it's pouring off of him like a waterfall. So after that, you just don't notice it anybody else. That's, you know.
Where's my sweat rag?
Well, guys, I think maybe we can segue into the death clock.
Man. I believe you are correct, sir. So let's start with you, Matt.
All right. Well, I'm going to say that is it worth the hour and 50 minutes? No. The story, like I said, it's very combobulated. It's kind of hard to follow throughout parts of it. It seemed like there's a lot of moving pieces around. For a noir movie, there really isn't a whole lot that seemed like it was very riveting to keep me engaged into how the story was going. And it all boils down to just a battle between two characters that in the end, it really didn't matter because, you know, the guy was crooked and the guy that they arrested was the guy that killed the construction manager. As far as an entertaining detective noir movie, I would rather watch like Chinatown or The Two Jakes or Radioland Murders or Who Framed Roger Rabbit. You know,
it was better than The Two Jakes. You didn't get to see Madeline Stowe bend over and have the dirtiest clothed scene in cinema history, but it was better than The Two Jakes.
Well, I'll reserve that opinion if we ever do The Two Jakes.
Okay, so Matt, you're definitely not worth your death clock. So I guess, Joey, where does that put you then?
You know, it was interesting. It starts interesting. It ends interesting with the fact that, you know, the Captain Quinlan was correct. He planted evidence on the guilty party, but, you know, it doesn't make him a good cop. I'm sure some of the people he planted evidence on were innocent, but obviously he had good instincts and some of them were guilty. But it didn't, it was all the stuff in the middle that, like, you know, you got kind of lost. So it always have its place in history for that, you know, amazing continuous shot. But, you know, nowadays it's totally been outdone. I mean, if you want to shit your pants on continuous shots, there's a movie that appears to be one continuous shot called Birdman. And it got nominated for a bunch of awards, but it definitely won the ones for cinematography. So, watch Birdman if you want to just, you know, study the art of moving shots. But now this is just it's a footnote in history. I think if you're a film student, if you're studying film, you're a film historian, it's absolutely worth watching. If you're just the average run-of-the-mill Joe, you can skip this one.
All right, Tim.
All right.
What about you?
Well, I'm going to stick to my guns. I feel the story gets lost in the excellent cinematography and even the audio score. I feel like maybe if you watch it several times, the story may become more of a focus, but it's an hour and 48 minutes, and I'm not interested in turning this into a 5.5 hour viewing quest for that to happen. So I'm going to say totally not worth your death clock. It's just, this is a hard pass for me.
Wow. So that's three notes.
Yeah.
That's a first.
It's a first. We were
discussing this earlier, how we could make the film better. So it's, it's the detective is Captain, Jabba the Hutt, Captain Jabba. And then we have in the Charlton Heston role, we're going to have. Help me out, guys.
I'm thinking.
I can't think. It's
fucking Lando Calrissian. Lando Calrissian.
No.
Yes.
In the role of Charlton Heston.
In the role of Charlton
Heston. We're going to have Sean Connery.
Oh, okay.
He is going to play a Mexican, and he is not going to be. He is a man who does not like wearing makeup. He is not going to wear makeup. He is just going to say his name is Vargas.
Okay.
And then, Jet Lay.
Slave
Leia. Carrie Fisher in Slave Leia outfit. All right. Who's going to play Uncle Joe? Uncle Joe Grande. Grandy.
I can only think of him from Community. The guy
Bobcat from Goldthwait.
Oh, that would be a good one. Yes, way better than what I was thinking. Bobcat Goldthwait all the way. But it have to be 80s Bobcat, not today's thin Bobcat.
Yeah.
So,
And did we say that Salacious Crumb was going to be Menzies?
Yeah. Yeah. I think I went there. Yeah. As trying to be, you know, have a good joke. But I don't know
who Salacious Crumb is.
That's the little guy that sits in Jabba all the time and just laughs. He's that little rat-looking guy. Yeah,
the character, the puppet.
Which was the whole laugh I tried to do. Yeah, I used to be able to hit that, and I can't do it anymore. I've lost that range. It's no longer available to me.
Let's keep the night manager as the guy who was the night manager.
Oh, yeah.
I think he nailed it.
Yeah. But
so that's a nice rewatchable, timeless trash film.
Well, hang on. We haven't done Quinlan, though. So I'm thinking
Quinlan's Jabba.
Quinlan's Jabba the Hutt.
That's true.
Actually, Jabba the Hutt.
But if you're going to take a real person, I'm thinking Tyler the Bean, the guy from what is that horror film that I love so much? That
you can look it up on the internet. It's right in front of you.
I could. Yeah,
Tucker and Dale.
Yeah, Tucker and Dale versus Evil. Okay. Tyler the Bean.
Oh God, you in that fucking movie?
We got your friend. but he would
give you some
one.
Background, guys. I'm gonna give you some background. Tim has a Halloween party every year, and for about 7 years in a row, he played Tucker and Dale versus Evil.
It's a great.
It's a good. It's a fun movie.
Third fucking time, I think we were all done.
Everybody wants it. No, you're the only one because you want to play like all kinds of different stuff. Everybody asks every year. They ask for that movie. They want to watch Idle Hands and Shaun of the Dead. It's the trifecta of awesomeness at Halloween. Like that's what you have to play. And then after I gave up on introducing
good stuff. Yeah, when we used to stay after 1 o'clock in the morning, then I got to play whatever the fuck I wanted, and it was always people were always like questioning their reality. They're like they'd never heard. Of Dead Alive or whatever I happen to put on. And
Joey, why are you watching Naked Lunch again? Come on.
Hey, I'll say this.
I'm not going to do that on Halloween. There's parts of it that are very Halloween.
Joey, this year I played all the Treehouse of Horrors. I didn't play any of those movies.
That's true. You made it the most kid-friendly party ever. Except for me swearing at Matt because the trivia kept going back to animated films as the fucking answer.
And with that, I'm going to go to mail call. Folks, this is where you have the opportunity to get your voice heard right here on Middle Age Movie Reviews Podcast. If there's anything that you have on your mind about any of the movies we've covered, whether it's Apocalypse Now or Touch of Evil, shoot us an email and we'll read it right here on the show. Tonight, we have a very special email from Baron Educational Books.
What?
What you say?
Yes. What do we say? What?
It is... I am sorry, but we do not publish the book anymore. You will want to get a latest copy and look at the copyright page and bother them for an interview.
Oh, you're trying to get an interview with the author?
Yeah, I am trying to get an interview with the author.
No, nice. Because my first question for that guy is, did you really watch all these movies?
I think he watched half of them.
I think he did the Joey fast forward is what he did.
So hopefully I can continue to be a detective. And find the appropriate person to give the stick of dynamite to get an interview.
Well, I think this is a good time to ask our audience of 12. If any of you know where to find the author of this book, please let us know. Because we'll bring him on if he'll come on. And, you know, we'll ask him our questions and yours.
Yes.
Well, I think this brings us up to the What Are We Watching Now segment.
Well, yes. Tim, what are you watching now?
Well, I have taken a break from watching all the TV series that I keep bringing up every week. And I actually did a double feature movie this week. I tried to broaden my son's horizon and try to get him to watch 1992's Wayne's World with me, which was about halfway through. Dad, I'm just not into this. And then he was done, which made me very sad. And I finished watching it nonetheless because, you know, it's Wayne's World and it's got Tia Carrere in it. So who doesn't want to finish that show, right?
Right.
And then I went straight from that into 1996's Space Truckers because I felt like we haven't got to talk about Dennis Hopper in a while. And I thought, let's bring up this movie, a movie that is so awesome that it is not even on Dennis Hopper's Wikipedia film credits page. So it's just completely missing. I looked it up. I'm like, when, you know, was this? I was wondering if it was the last movie he did or whatever. Could never tell you. Space Truckers. It actually has Dennis Hopper in it and George Windett, you know, old Norm from Cheers.
Oh, nice.
Yes.
I've never heard of Space Truckers. What's it about?
I heard you talking about it.
It is exactly what you would think it's about. It is literally about space truckers. Literally guys driving around big rigs with space cargo. And he's trying to, you know, Dennis Hopper is like the last independent trucker fighting the man, not wanting to be part of the conglomerate of truckers, and gets into a fight with the head of the, I don't know if he's like a trucker's guild, or just the guy who basically has got all the truckers working for him, which is George Windip, by the way, or Keller is the character. And so he takes a load of cargo to go back to Earth illegally, partly because there's a girl named Cindy who works at the space diner where he goes to bring a load of square pigs. I shit you not, square pigs. And she's like, I need to get back to Earth because my mother's going to have an operation. She's like, if you go, I'll marry you. Of course, she's like 30 years younger than him. And then he also manages to get into a fight during this, and with George Windit's character Keller, gets into trouble, has to leave right away. Some other kid that was going to start working for George Windit's group, he basically says, I'm not going to be part of that anymore. I'm your partner, who's also in love with the Cindy girl. And they jump into the trucking space rig and start their voyage to Earth, and shenanigans, you know, ensue from there. So it is
George Wendt.
I'm sorry. Wendt.
Not Windit.
Sorry.
I was going to let him go with it. I mean, you know.
I couldn't handle it. By the third time, I was like, I'm going to be an asshole.
No, it's all good. I mispronounce names all the time. It's a fact of life I live with. So
my favorite gag is George Wendt. Where'd he go?
Nice. But yeah, so it's a solid 1980s B movie that was filmed in 1996. So yeah, it's, you can.
Nice.
I don't know where you can find it. I actually found it on YouTube. So if you want to go see it, go look it up. You could probably find it on YouTube and watch it for free. So it's a one time. Actually, the most fascinating part of the whole show is they actually did a very good job with like the scenery and the props. It's kind of fun to watch just for that. You know, they did a really good job with it. Oh, and did I mention there's killer robots that for some reason in this show can only be stopped with a garage door opener. So yeah, it's just like my last recommendation of my B movie of the class of 1999. Again, killer robots are involved. So yeah, it's a good time.
Are there any cyborgs in it?
No.
Cause every good B movie, it's gotta have a good cyborg.
No, just robots. But that's it.
Nice.
But that, like I said, but they are controlled by, the only way you can defeat them is with this one garage door that rules them all. So
how about you, Joey? What are you watching?
Come back to me.
All right. Well, then I'll let you guys know what I'm watching. I actually haven't watched anything. I've actually stepped away from TV for a little bit, and I've cracked open something that you guys probably haven't heard for in a while, and that is a book. Yes, a book. Sounds a little bit like this. And I'll level with you, it's not really so much a book as it's a comic book. I've been reading the new Incredible Hulk series. It's written by this guy, Philip Kennedy Johnson. Now, I know we mostly talk about, you know, movies and everything, and yeah, okay, so Ang Lee did a Hulk movie there. That's a tie into the movies, but the Incredible Hulk comic book is effing amazing. It's the artwork. They have this new transformation for the Hulk. Like, the Hulk is literally ripping himself out of Bruce Banner. I mean, there's this panel where you can see the Hulk's fingers like coming out of Bruce Banner's mouth as he's like pulling his skin away. It's almost like a werewolf transformation. And the whole premise is that the Hulk is battling these ancient monsters, and these monsters want to take over the Hulk's body to release something called like the mother of all monsters. And it's like 1980s horror comics all over again. And it's like Marvel's Incredible Hulk, you know, something I normally would give my kid. And it's amazing. The artwork is just phenomenal. I honestly would love to see this as an MCU movie. Maybe not an MCU, maybe like, you know, the darker side of it, the MCU.
So another studio doing it besides Disney is what you're saying.
Exactly. Yeah.
And
I'm guessing that the transformation sequence was inspired by Nightmare on Elm Street Part 2 or possibly Demons.
Yes.
Because it's tearing out of him. Both, I recommend both of those movies, by the way.
Well, I'm going to give you a pass on the comic book thing, Matt, because we've all seen that first Hulk movie, and what a hunk of shit that is. You know, I mean, it's, you watch that thing, and it's like a video editor's wet dream about three-fourths of the way through, and then somebody walks in the room and is like, knock it the fuck off, and then they finally turn it into a real movie and finish it. So it's a horrible, horrible movie to watch. I mean, the second one they made for the actual MCU universe is much better. But that first one, oh my gosh, just the worst Hulk movie you could ever watch. So yeah, going back to print, that was a good call.
Yeah.
I salute you, sir.
Thank you.
All right. So Joey, what are you watching?
I am watching a lot of fucking TV right now. So I just finished Expats on Amazon. Holy fuck. It's just about despicable rich people. So, they string you along. They make you think it's going to go somewhere. They use a lot of, tropes from sitcoms where people get stuck in an elevator. So they have to confront each other about what's going on. And it ultimately goes nowhere. So I'm going to have to say pass on Expats. It certainly had its moments. It certainly was interesting, but it was not good. I've started two new things. The Walking Dead has come back with the Ones Who Live, and the first episode was surprisingly watchable. It's probably because I'm comparing it to the trash that was Fear the Walking Dead, which is their one of the most recent series that wrapped up. If I'm comparing it to the Daryl spinoff, I'd say it's even keel. And comparing it to the last seasons of Walking Dead that, you know, wrote out both Andrew Lincoln's character and Michonne. Holy shit. I mean, you can't do much worse than those unless, you know, we're talking about the spinoff series. Help me out. The Forgettable. I can't even remember the name of the spinoff series. What the fuck was it called?
Fear the Walking Dead?
No.
Another one.
The one with the young people.
Yeah, that was so bad. So bad.
Not the WB. It was like the CW's Walking Dead. What the fuck was it called?
I never got into The Walking Dead, so I really can't help you.
It was World Beyond. World Beyond is what you're trying to think of.
World Beyond. It got greenlit for a second season before the first episode aired. And then after the first episode aired, they quickly said, this is going to be a finite show and there'll only be two seasons.
Yeah, it was not really World Beyond. It was just beyond shitty.
Yes, it was beyond the pale of watchable television. So I do recommend watching the first episode of Those Who Live. I can't comment on the series yet. I just started today. I haven't even finished the first episode. And we're going to bring it back to my holy trinity of European skanks. Noomi Rapace is in an Apple TV original called Constellation, and she is once again a astronaut. This time she's on the International Space Station. She's not on a quest to go find the origins of humankind like she was in Prometheus, but she's still looking good. She's a hot MILF, and they also have Mike Ehrmantraut from Better Call Saul and Breaking Bad in it, playing the oldest NASA engineer that has ever lived, apparently. And I'm ready to finish the first episode. I'm drawn into it, and it looks like it's going to hopefully be good and not be a bag of shit like series like Lost, where they're like, well, let's just keep dragging out the mystery until we have a final episode inspired by another series with Lost in the title, except it was by Sid and Marty Croft, Land of the Lost. Yes, the whole fountain thing and the water and stuff. They stole some shit from Land of the Lost.
From Land of the Lost, man. I love that show.
That show, you knew what you were getting into. There's stop motion fucking dinosaurs. But high budget Land of the Lost, or high budget Lost, didn't live up to the hype. They pulled you in. They used a little, you know, storytelling techniques, the mystery, and then it just didn't fucking pay off at all. In Land of the Lost, they lost their fucking father in the third series because he wanted more money, so they wrote him out. And then at the beginning of each episode, you see their dad get sucked into the doorway of time. And when you're a little kid watching that, and you realize, oh my God. Everybody around me is gonna, you know, pass away someday. Everybody's mortal. And that just scared the shit out of me. And it was the worst effects ever. And I look at it now and laugh, but oh my God, that was a show.
And there you are, everybody. Now you know why Joey is the way Joey is.
The sleaze fucked my brain.
I do have a question though. So I've heard rumors that this new Walking Dead series has a possibility of a Morgan return. Have you seen this? Is this something that you noticed or that's been brought up in it?
I don't know jack shit about that.
Okay. I was just curious. You'll have to report in next week and let me know. Cause I do like me some Morgan in the Walking Dead. It was always a character I enjoyed.
And yeah. He's British.
Yeah, I know he is. Cause
all of the good actors on the Walking Dead were poached from Britain.
Yeah.
I think that's true about a lot of shows though.
Rick Grimes, Coral, is British.
And with that, everybody, thanks for listening to the Middle Age Movies Reviews Podcast. We hope you've enjoyed the movie and maybe even Joey.
Subscribe to our show on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or Podchaser. Check out more of our stuff at Facebook at MAM Reviews. That's for Middle Age Movie Reviews, as well as episode posts and news on Elon Musk's X. We are also part of the Electronic Media Collective Podcast Network. As Joey likes it, it's a mouthful.
Good night, and get your hands off me, you damn dirty ape. Hey, thanks for listening. We're giving a digital code away for Who Framed Roger Rabbit. That's right. We're going to give you a touch of goodness. If you are the first one to email our show at mamreviewspodcast@gmail.com, that's MAM review, singular, podcast@gmail.com, then it's yours. Just say, hey, I enjoyed this show. How about me some Roger Rabbit?